welcome to Tiny Voice Talks with me, Tori Bono. And if you tuned in to the last episode, you will know that I talked to Aisha Thomas, the fabulous author of the book Representation Matters, all about why representation is so important in our educational system. Now, I left you hanging, and I do apologise, but we discussed so many great points that it felt that I actually needed to devote two episodes to it. So I'm really sorry for leaving you hanging, but just think, right now, ahead of you, you've got even more great discussions between Aisha and I, all about the importance of representation in schools and how to get there. And I think what we discussed before was the fact that I can't even begin to understand what that is like. The fact that actually you will never
empathize with it.
No,
you can try, but it will never be your existence ever.
No. And yet we feel that we need to empathize with everything, and we can't. We actually can't. So I'm going to ask a really weird question.
Oh.
Does decolonizing the curriculum sort this problem?
No. In my opinion, I don't think it sorts it. What I think is decolonization is a tool or a strategy that can be used in order to provide greater awareness and understanding. It is the beginnings of looking at a system and wanting to dismantle it by being honest about colonization. That's what that's about. But the reason why, similarly to what I said about D&I or EDI, whatever acronym you wish to use, decolonization has become weaponized as a term, and it's being bandied around all of the time. And my question is how many of us really know what decolonization means? Because I actually think in most instances, we are representing, we are adding a bit of diversity, we will be questioning culture and heritage. But decolonization takes a process. You are actually saying, firstly, I need to decolonize my mind. I'm going to remove myself from the state. I'm going to remove myself from the knowledge and understanding of the world that I currently have through a particular lens. That's an individual piece of work to be done.
Yeah.
But you're also up against a system that you're trying to decolonize at the same time. But understand this. Why would you decolonize a system that is already doing what you want the system to do? Because if I am white, the system's doing what it needs to do for me. Why do I need to change it? Mm. Now, I'm not saying there aren't individuals who see it as wrong, individuals who can see that white supremacy is at play. There aren't individuals who can see how privilege is different and they are doing the things that they can within their power. But look at it globally for a second. When you're thinking about privilege, you're saying that I have something that someone else doesn't have. And somehow I need to give up that thing for someone else to have a little bit more of what I have. But as humans, it's hard to give up something that you already have.
Yeah.
It's hard to give up a current existence. And so what we end up doing is we do as much as we feel we are happy to do. We give up as much as we're willing to give up. And then we all have a stop point. We all have a point where we don't wish to compromise. And we see that particularly under points of crisis and pressure. So when you see people go, oh, go back home, there aren't enough houses. This is the same person who would have been clapping for the NHS with the same people who would have been treating them and caring for them from other countries. Mm-hmm. But now I'm under pressure and I've got nowhere to live and there are no jobs and the gas and electric prices are going up and I can't afford my petrol. It's your fault. You need to leave the country. You're taking our resources. But you don't see colour. So how do you know it's me? Oh, no. And do you see how you begin to realise that? Pressure, all of it is very much there. So when we think about this notion of decolonization, you're trying to dismantle an entire system and way of thinking that has served for so long.
Within schools, we are very paper-based. We like a policy, we like a plan. And it's like, oh, we now have a new plan. We've got a new curriculum and we've decolonized. But what you're saying is it's not about what's on paper. It's about what's in our minds.
It's what you're living.
Yeah.
Okay. You said something to me at the beginning and it makes sense to me. When we first started talking, you very much acknowledged that you are racialized as a white woman, white, yes, middle-class woman in a middle-class profession, yeah? I am racialized as a black woman in a middle-class profession. That's exactly where we both are. You could give us both the exact same curriculum material, curriculum plan, and structure and say, here is the classroom, go and deliver it.
Yeah.
The issue that we have is this isn't about teaching styles. I'm not talking about pedagogy right now so much, but I'm just talking about how we interpret the information to decide how we're going to deliver. We will both deliver it differently. Why? Because my understanding and my connection with it is completely different to yours.
Yes, yes.
Here's an example of this, and I won't name the school because I don't wish to disclose, but it's a good example for us to understand. There was a child who was in a history lesson, and her dad was a scholar, and he had taught her so much about understanding African history, African kingdoms. And they were having a lesson on British Empire. And this particular teacher was a historian, and he was talking, and he said, you know, there were different slaves had different benefits. That was the language he used. And he also had said, you know, the house slaves, they were able to access education, they had better clothing, better access to food, and the field slaves were treated like this and they did that. She, this particular child, challenged him and said, sir, I need you to understand that nobody benefited in slavery except the white people. There is no black person who benefited from being treated like a slave. And not even treated like, was a slave, was a slave. And she was able to bring up some really difficult things the teacher didn't want to hear. She challenged him by saying, imagine what it would feel like to watch your husband be lynched in front of you. Imagine what it would feel like to watch your wife be raped in front of you. Imagine what it'd be like to have meat attached to you and have dogs savage you. Sir, I challenge you to tell me again there was a benefit. Now, what's interesting, no one else in the class understood what she was saying. No one in the class understood her existence. He, as a teacher racialized as white, didn't understand her existence.
Yeah.
So even though he felt he was being inclusive, he felt that he was, telling it from different perspectives, he didn't understand it. So when you talk about decolonization, unless he can decolonize his mind and understand enslavement, understand colonization, understand the pain and trauma and horror, he's still going to teach as an abstract thing, a theory, a Hollywood blockbuster like 12 Years a Slave. That's what he's going to do. But for her, someone who's been taught about what truly happened from an African, or should I say, I won't name the place, I don't want to show any kind of identity markers for her, but through the lens of experience of what she had, she saw the world differently. Her mind is decolonized. His isn't. But we're still in the same classroom, the same materials, with the same information. So when we talk about decolonization, even if you're trying to decolonize materials or you think you have, decolonized it for who? Because unless you're hearing from the very people you're talking about in the content and you're understanding their lived experiences within it, then you've just made it more palatable for yourself.
Yeah. So how do we get there?
I genuinely believe there are a number of things that need to happen, and some of the things are beyond our control. Let's be quite clear. We cannot control much of what happens in the curriculum just by saying we don't like it. So we have to think about our examining boards. We need to think about the materials, who's writing them, who's producing them, whose voices are being heard, who is quality assuring it, whose lived experiences are existing in our very resources and materials. What we also have to be able to do is be honest about holding the mirror to our own identity and our understanding as educators, so we know what we're bringing into our classrooms in any shape or form. I talk about it in the book, The Triple Consciousness, this idea of being honest. You know, who are you at home? Who are you as an educator? Who are you in the context of education and your wider school? So if I say to you the words white supremacy, white fragility, whiteness, you will have a view of what those words mean to you in your house, in your home, with your family. Okay?
Yeah.
When you step into your school, you will then have another understanding of what those words mean to you, or how far you feel you can go.
Yeah.
There might be things you do on your podcast that you wouldn't do in school. And it's not because you're being fake. It's because you have your limitations of how far you can go. And then you start thinking about, well, I'm a primary school teacher, I'm teaching year four students. Let me think about what other schools are doing. Is this age appropriate or is it not? And you see how it can then become palatable and diluted, because, you know, the version of you that was at home and you were like, no, I'm going to fight for this. I'm an ally. I've got an awakening. I'm going in and I'm going to say this. All of a sudden, it just goes back to, so we're going to do a bit of diversity and inclusion, and we're going to add a bit of representation, and I've put up some black faces and I've got some black crayons, because as you go through that process of alignment with who you are at home and who you're expected to be in education, you begin to see all your limitations. So it's about, what can you do as an individual in your classroom with your students, with your parents, to do the most good? What are you willing to do collectively, collaboratively as a school? Do a quality impact assessment. Actually, I'm going to do a pupil pursuit of what it would be like to be a black child in my school. I'm going to walk around. I'm going to be with them. I'm going to see what they experience and what they see. I'm going to look at our policies and processes for the lens of a black child. I'm going to see how it would impact them. Are there any disproportionate implications on their lived experience? For example, all of our students must wear their hair back in a bun. Well, that's not going to work for me, is it? So if I'm a black child with Afro hair and the policy says that, has anybody spotted it? Maybe not, because everyone else is white with straight hair. They don't even see it as a problem. Then you go and you look at your curriculum materials and you begin to think about, well, which perspectives are we telling these stories from? Is it always pain, trauma and deficit? Or are we adding black joy to the way we talk to our children, so that not only black children feel empowered, but white children look at black children and go, you add value the same as I do. You're not here just as a second class citizen. I would love to say there's one way to do this. There isn't one way. And the reason there isn't one way is because racialized experiences cut through every single aspect of society. I challenge you to find me somewhere in society where race doesn't come up as part of the conversation, whether we wish to acknowledge it or not. It is there. So there is no way then I can give you one way to fix this. The only way for this to be fixed is if society as a whole is revisited. If we are dismantling that hierarchy and that supremacy, if we as individuals collectively take a responsibility, both us racialized as black and brown and those racialized as white, then there's just might be a little bit of hope that as we move forward, we bring back humanity. And that's my hope.
Yeah. So how would, because, you know, professional development, when you're talking, it sounds to me like actually the starting point needs to be us developing ourselves.
100%.
Where does professional development come into this? How would professional development look to actually really shift educators in this way?
I think we need to do this in two parts. So I have spent this year working on the teacher training program, and I had an entire inclusion model, never been done before on the PGC undergrad. But what was really interesting is I took them through that process. So as well as learning their subject areas, they were coming to have lectures with me, and I'm talking to them about identity, culture, who you are, how you show up, and really critically examining these lenses. We have a set of teachers going into school now already with a thinking process, a thought, a reflection, a toolkit that the very teachers they're going to go and work with don't have, because they're having to learn this as part of their teacher training. That's important. You look at the teaching standards and you look at the way in which we are trained to teach, and there is no focus on this being part of the skill that we require. Mm-hmm. And yet we somehow expect teachers to go into the classroom and be prepared for the global majority. But yet we're not treating it as something that's just as important as learning literacy and numeracy, which it is, because identity is the core of who we are, the humanity, the legacy that we want children to leave with when they leave our schools. But what I would say in terms of CPD for educators, those of us who are in schools and already working, it has to be a part of something you keep revisiting. So the same way you do your annual safeguarding training, the same way you might do your annual training on looking at different core materials, we need to be giving staff chances to talk about and have brave spaces about critical conversations about identity and culture. We need to give people space to question what they experience. you know, imagine going into your school after the pandemic and saying, we saw a lot of vicarious racial trauma. Let's talk about it. What does that mean for us now? How is that showing up in your classrooms? How is that showing up in your materials? How is it showing up in how you engage with each other? Imagine if that was your CPD, because you would have all had a lot of questions. We'd all had a lot of things to think about. We had a lot of things to say. Where has it gone? It's not disappeared. You've just suppressed it. But imagine if you talked about it, then when that child with that pencil didn't colour their face in, it wouldn't have been so difficult for you to know what to do next, because you would have thought, oh, yeah, we talked about this and we questioned this, and actually this is my approach. I'm going to talk to her mum, or I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And it would have all came much more natural. But the reason it didn't is because you're moving in a silo. You've done the work. We haven't done the work. And so it's the collective responsibility within CPD to provide those opportunities. It's about, when you are doing your CPD sessions, are you allowing racialized experiences to be a critical lens that you just check when you're delivering your other CPD? Are you allowing that to be part of a standing item that keeps coming up? Because we can't do it once. When incidents happen, do we put on spontaneous CPD sessions that are relevant? So when child Q happened, did we take a moment and go, do we need to have an extraordinary meeting about this? Do we need to have a CPD session where we just think about our safeguarding processes, and if anyone was racialized in a particular way, what might happen? And it's about making all of that a part of the process, as well as things like, what's our shared language in our school? How do we talk about race and racialized experiences? What are our ethos and values? Do they chime in with the very work that we're trying to achieve? And it's making sure that everybody, so that it becomes that golden thread, you are all talking about the same thing when you're having those conversations. Doesn't mean we don't get it wrong. What it means is that we have a culture where we can discuss it, explain it, help each other, and genuinely move forward as a group of people. It's about sharing that good practice. It's about saying, you know, have you seen this podcast? Have you read this article? Have you watched this post on Instagram? It's about all the little things that we can do together. But what we need to do is stop making EDI or anti-racist practice work a job. It's an extra thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've sort of seamlessly taken me to the next thing, which is language. And I want to talk to you about language, because language is so tricky.
Yeah.
And you've said, you've been using a phrase today that I really like. They are racialized as, which, and I hadn't necessarily heard of that. And actually, I used that earlier in the episode myself, because I picked up on what you said and I thought, I really like that. Yeah. And what I love in the book is that you talk about language and the importance of language. How, apart from reading your book, which we will do, how do we make sure we get language right?
I think the most important thing is what you've just said. How do we get language right? The issue is, it won't always be right.
Okay. And I think
the first thing we have to acknowledge is that we will get it wrong, and it will keep changing. It's ever evolving. So, for example, there would have been a time where, and I'm not going to use the N-word in full or anything like that, but there would have been times, for example, where a term like coloured is a term that was used. So there'll be people in education now who would have used that term to describe children, okay? Mm-hmm. We don't use that word anymore. And yet now people are saying, but you can say people of colour. So I've got someone going to me, but Aisha, I'm told I can't use colour, but now I'm being told person of colour is an acceptable term, but it's still got the word colour and I don't know what to do. What do I say? Help. And it's the idea of, actually, it's less for me about necessarily always getting it right, but it's how you react when you get it wrong. That, I think, is just as important as the things you say. So, of course, in any school, you might want to have a list. And it might be a list or a glossary that is changing over time, and you give yourself time to reflect and review it, and you ask different children and parents what they think and what they feel, particularly those for whom it's a lived experience. But it's about saying, okay, do we use the word BAME anymore? Well, actually, why would we not use BAME? Well, we know that BAME as a term is just an acronym to group everybody who isn't white British.
Yeah.
Actually, that reinforces this them and us. So we're not going to use BAME. We're actually going to call people and actually label them as what they are. Okay. cool, or how they feel comfortable. Great. So actually, we're going to get rid of BAME. We're not going to use that. But you might well say, okay, the term black, can we use it? Now, as interestingly, prior to the 1960s, if you'd called somebody black, there would be people who would want to fight you as a result. It was definitely not a social term that was accepted. But now it's assumed now that black is a way that people describe themselves. I'm black. Okay. All right. That's how I'm going to identify. So I feel like that's a term that we can use. But it's context, right? If I went to America now and I called someone black, they'd be like, who are you calling black? Because that's not a term that they use in America. It would be African-American. So it's all about context. It's all about where you are. So I think it's less about focusing on a set of words. Yes, that's important because you kind of want to have a rough idea of what you can and cannot use. But it's about asking people to express, well, how would you like me to racialize you? How would you like me to connect with your identity? And I had this in a meeting the other day. Somebody said, I never heard of the term racialized. Now, the reason why I say racialized is because it is the way I've been racialized. Society has said, I am racializing you as black, and that's what I'm going to call you. I didn't wake up and go, I'm black. That's what I am. I've been racialized as black.
Yes.
And then they said, but what's the difference then between that and ethnic minority? Because what I explained is your ethnicity is not necessarily the same as how you were racialized. So you and I could both be Spanish, for example. Mm-hmm. Both born in Spain, both Spanish. But we would be racialized differently. So I would be racialized as a black Spanish. You'd be racialized as a white Spanish. But the interesting fact is we would both still be ethnic minorities here because Spain, or being Spanish, would be the ethnic minority whilst in Great Britain with the global majority. Do you see the difference?
Gosh, that's deep.
So you can be an ethnic minority and be racialized as white and still not be subject to some of the hirsch and the heart that people who are racialized as black are, because you have your racialized experience of white that will protect you in a world that appreciates and puts white supremacy at the top. So the fact that you're white and you're Spanish, you're Spanish, you are an ethnic minority, but do you know what? The fact that you're racialized as white, we're going to put you here.
Yeah.
And so understanding the differences between ethnicity and ethnic minority as a term, as well as understanding what we mean when we talk about people being black or racialized as black, they're two different things and you need to understand both.
Yes.
And so when someone does challenge you, so say you said, so my friend, this is the real story of what happened to my friend last week. She was in a focus group and they were really talking about empowerment and things. And the person went, you know, because you're a person of color. And my friend went, don't call me a person of color. I'm black. That's how I want you to address me. I'm a black person. And then the person who she said it to was like, oh, I'm so sorry. I thought it was okay to say person of color. And she said, it might be for some, but I'm not a person of color. I am black. So do you know what? That's how I want you to identify me. Now, what's important is how you respond next. Now, you could be quite defensive. Oh, I'm fed up with all these words. Oh my gosh, I'm trying to get it right. I've said this and it's wrong. And I'm just, do you know what? It's fine. Or you could be like, do you know, I didn't really see color. I'm only saying it because everyone's told me to. Or you could go, do you know what? I hear you.
Yeah.
I was wrong in that moment. I understand that not all people racialize themselves or identify in the same way. I'm going to own it. And do you know what I'm going to do next time? Next time I meet somebody, I'm just going to ask them, how would you like me to identify you?
And that's so important because I actually have I've got three friends, all of whom have different, they all like and dislike the BAME sort of acronym as such. So one of them actually is happy to be referred to as BAME.
Yeah.
One of them passionately hates being referred to as BAME. Mm-hmm. And one of them hates being referred to as BAME, but doesn't mind being referred to as BAME.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered that by having that conversation that you have just described, where I've said BAME or something, and they've said, I don't like that. And it's like, oh, what is it you would like? Yeah. Because I think we've got to have that courage to ask the questions and ensure that we are getting it right by actually asking the questions. Because as you said, language is tricky. And we may well be carrying around our dictionary of correct things to be saying, But actually, that might be right for one person, but it might not be right for another person. And we have to make sure that, you know, it's, I suppose it's, that's where white fragility comes in, isn't it? You know, as a white person, I'm like, oh my goodness, no, I've got it wrong. I was trying so hard to get it right. I've read 3 million books and I'm still getting it wrong.
You freeze, right? And so now I'm just going to call you a tool. I'm going to avoid you. I'm going to go. So the funniest thing that happened, I was at an event. And sometimes I do think it gets a bit silly. So I was at an event and someone was looking for me. Mm-hmm. They were trying to describe me, but they didn't want to use the word black. I'm like, for goodness sake, I'm the only black person in the room. Just say, and I get why they was probably a little bit, you know, a little bit fragile about saying it. And it was like, so she's got short hair. And she's about this high. And I could literally just hear them saying all these different ways of which to try and describe me. And I was like, it's me. It's the black girl with the afro. That's who it is. Now, in that context, I knew he wasn't trying to cause any hurt or harm.
Yeah.
If somebody was being disrespectful and walking down the street and they were doing it in a derogatory way, oh, yeah, the black girl with the afro, that's different. But if you're trying to describe me and we're in a hurry and you want the person just to give me the item, it's just easy to go, are you just the one racialized as black? The one over there in the corner, the one with a little afro? Then they know it's me. And for me, that wouldn't have caused me any offense. Mm. Rather than being in a room of 500 people, I was the only black person in there, and you're trying to describe me like a game of Guess Who, but you don't want to use my race because you're really worried about causing offense. But you're just making it take a whole lot longer just to get to the point. So I'm not saying that to be, I am being flippant in this particular example. But what I'm saying is that sometimes we can get so caught up in how we look as the person not trying to get it wrong that we forget the experience of the person that we're actually trying to talk to or talk about.
Yeah.
And that's why you have to decenter. And decentering is really important. Position yourself as the learner or position yourself as the person who's having the lived experience, then always be the person who's trying to say it through their lens. I mean, I've had to do a lot of learning, particularly for me, around pronouns. And learning about pronouns has been really, really important experience for me.
Yeah.
And have I got it wrong? Of course I have. But rather than me go, oh my gosh, I've got it wrong. Oh my gosh, I've embarrassed you. Oh my gosh. And really drawing attention to that person, I'm having to go, okay, so how best should I deal with it? And I had a particular child in my class who said, Miss, when you get it wrong, even if you acknowledge you've got it wrong in your head, please don't call it out in front of everybody. We all know. We don't have to do that. Because that was more about me than it was about this particular person.
Yeah.
I wanted to make myself feel like I was okay. I wasn't worrying about that person. But if I'm getting it wrong 20 times in the lesson and I say that 20 times and keep interrupting the lesson just to apologize, I'm making that person's experience really difficult.
Yeah.
So it's the intent, but also the impact.
Yeah. And it's funny that you mentioned about the pronouns, because I've got a 15-year-old daughter who has no issue with pronouns. It's just the most natural thing in the world to her to use whatever pronouns. And, you know, and I remember she came home one day and said that one of her friends wanted to be referred to as they and them.
Yeah.
And I said, and I apologize if this offends any listeners right now, I said, why does she want to do that? And my daughter said, you mean, why do they want to do that, Mum?
Yes. And you're like,
oh. Yeah. And I'm like, oh,
yeah. Right.
And it was, I had the best conversation, but what I suppose I'm getting at is that actually for my teenage daughter, it has been very natural and very quick and very easy to assimilate in that way, in a way that probably because we go back to that coding, my coding is such that, you know, it has been much, much trickier to change my coding around pronouns.
Yeah. And similarly to race. So it's hard to get people to understand that there are terms you can't use. You have to evolve. I think it was Malcolm X who talks about racism and says, you know, it's like a Cadillac. Every year a new version comes out. And I think it's similar to that in terms of language. The language keep changing. I cannot say to you that you can call me black today and that will be the case for the next 50 years. It might well change, but stop being upset about the fact that you need to evolve and be more happy about the fact that there's someone who now feels that they are being identified and that they can exist socially and well in our current existence without feeling that they feel marginalized because of the label that you're now giving them. Let's just focus more about them and less about us. And I think that's the shift we need to make.
That's linked to the white fragility, though, isn't it?
Of course.
You know, the fact that actually we get so paranoid about getting it right that it becomes about us. It suddenly becomes about that white person in the room and thinking, oh, no, I need to get it right because otherwise they'll think badly of me. And suddenly we've shifted that lens entirely. You know, and I know that I have done that where I have shifted the lens onto me because it's become about me and getting it right as opposed to about the other person.
Exactly that. And so if we would just take the time to decenter and acknowledge our fragilities, go back to our core beliefs and why we're fearful, we can then put ourselves as educators in a much better place to create a culture of understanding, getting it wrong, making mistakes, but actually really centering the other person's experience before our own.
Yeah, which makes entire sense. Now, the book, I'm going to mention the book now. We've talked so much. Finally mentioned the book. But the book is brilliant. I love the way you have set it out. But I would say to listeners, you need time. You need time for this book because it's not a rush. And you need a brand new notebook to sit beside you, I would say. Because actually what I love, Aisha, is that you ask hard-hitting questions. You start off with, who are you? What are your core beliefs and values? Actually, you know, I found that just getting through chapter one and actually really, really deeply thinking about some of those things, you know, so what there was one, this was it. When did you first realize you were racialized? When did it happen? Where did it happen? Was it a positive or negative experience? So I would say, listeners, there is so much to this book. You need a notebook. You need time and you need to really think deeply because that's what I've found that I have had to do with this book. But I've also, I'll be honest, I need to go back to it. And it's going to be one of those books that I'm going back to again and again and again, because as you said, Aisha, actually, we are continually evolving. We are continually changing. And what it isn't is I'm going to read this book and oh, tick, I'm done, because it's, as you've said again and again, when this is not a tick box exercise.
No, 100%. And you have to be willing to keep going back. You have to be willing to keep sense checking. You have to be willing to keep holding the mirror.
Absolutely. So Aisha, if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way?
So I have a website. So it's www.repmatters.co.uk. Equally, I am on all of the socials. So whether it's your Twitter, your Instagram, LinkedIn, you can catch me there. So I'm more than happy for people to do so. And actually on the back of the book, it's got the contact details on there as well, just in terms of my Twitter handle and also the website. Yeah. So yeah, reach out. And there's also lots of other resource material. So, if you know, things like my TED Talk, my BBC documentary, if people just want to find out more things about what they can do, there's lots of free resources. I've done a couple of things for the BBC. So all of those things are freely available if people want to do further learning.
Fantastic. And I will make sure everyone that those links are in the show notes. So just click on those and you'll be able to. So before I let you go, Aisha, there is one final question. And I have pre-warned you about my final question, which is this. If you could have been taught by anyone, living or dead, who would have been your perfect teacher?
Do you know what? That was such a hard question. And I'll tell you the reason why was because first of all, I'm going, Marcus Garvey. Then I'm like, no, Malcolm X. Then I'm like, no, but I would have loved to have heard from Sojourner Truth. And then I'm like, Jesus could have taught me a thing or two. So there was a loads of different things that came to mind. But I'm actually going to say, I think I already was taught by my perfect teacher.
Wow.
And the reason why I say that is because I remember one of my teachers who was my tutor group teacher, and he also was my resistant materials teacher. And whilst he didn't ever teach me about my racialized experience, that wasn't the thing. But what he did teach me was that, Aisha, you're special and there's something you're going to add to the world. And even when I doubted myself and I didn't think I was good enough, he always picked me up. And I don't know whether that was consciously because I was a racialized minority in my school. I don't know if it was because I was only, I think, one of two black students in his tutor group. And in fact, in my year group, one of six. I don't know. I would love to ask him. But what I will say is he held me. And I don't mean physically, but I mean emotionally. Yeah. He held me where he could see I felt that I didn't belong. He made me feel that I had a purpose and an existence. And even though at 11 years old, I couldn't think or feel it at that time, at 37, when you're posing that question to me, it took me right back to that point. He believed in me. And that is something as educators we need to do for every child that we have come through our classroom doors.
Wow. Aisha, it has been absolutely phenomenal speaking to you. It really has. You've just, you know, I've got to say, this has been a really candid conversation, which has really deepened my understanding. And I can't wait for more educators to get hold of your book. And I, you know, so thank you. Thank you for all you're doing. And I'm saying that from the entire education system, actually. Thank you
very much. Much appreciated.
Have a great day, and I shall let you go.
Take care. Bye.